Hey there, opera fans. I'm Eric Teague. My pronouns are he, him, his, and I'm primarily a costume designer. You may have seen some of my work in different houses around the U.S., but, fun fact, I'm also a trans man. Ever wondered how alternative identities thrive in the opera world? As someone who makes art for his living, I wanted to explore that question the best way I knew how, by talking to some folks. On this show, I'll speak with other artists who exist under the rainbow umbrella, and talk about life, work, and what makes us shine the brightest. So now I'm wearing a new hat, as your host for Come As You Are, the podcast that goes beyond the curtain with our industry's amazing artists from the LGBTQ+ community and our allies. Think of this as a virtual coffee hour with some fascinating people whose work you've heard or seen in your favorite shows. Whether singers, directors, technicians, or designers, the thing that we share in common is that we all defy the gender expectations often associated with our industry. So grab yourself a cup and join us for a good story. I have the distinct pleasure today to have with us someone who has made an indelible mark on the opera world. You have seen her work all over the globe at houses like the Met, La Scala, the Bolshoi, Covent Garden, Munich Staatsoper, Paris Opera, Lyric Opera of Chicago, English National Opera, Washington National Opera, the Kennedy Center, and of course, the Glimmerglass Festival. Believe me, this is but a sliver of her body of work and her accolades, but I'm pleased to call her a great colleague and friend. Please welcome to the program, Francesca Zambello. Thanks for being here.
Eric, I'm so happy to be with you.
You're the best. It's great that you've been able to carve out some time for us today, so we're deeply thankful. Here at Come As You Are, we like to introduce our identities and our orientations up top. For example, I'm your friendly neighborhood trans man with he, him pronouns. How about you?
Francesca Zambello and I use she and her.
So would you mind telling us a little bit about where and how you grew up?
Sure. Wow. Okay. Well, my father was Italian, my mother American. She was an actress, so I was around the theater at a very early age. I grew up in New York City and attended the theater a lot, went with her to the theater a lot. And then when I was 11, my family moved to Paris, France because of my father's business. He worked for TWA, the airline, and with defunct. And so I then spent junior high and high school in Paris, which was an incredible gift. Wow. And got to experience that amazing city, which in a way I probably appreciate even more now. And I was always around the theater. I loved the theater. I didn't really perform. I did a lot of, like, already when my mother would go someplace and work in the summer, she usually got me like an internship job. And that really led me to thinking about life as a director at an early age. I was already, you know, putting on shows in the basement and, you know, making puppets and all those things that, you know, I think a lot of directors do at an early age because you're thinking about the whole story. I went to Colgate University. I majored in philosophy, an incredibly useful thing. It used to be great to get a liberal arts education. I don't know anymore, but I do still believe in it because I think it helps you think. And then I launched into the world. I knew I wanted to be a director. I also wanted to be a director. And so I went to New York City and started working, you know, as an assistant stage manager and just anything to be in a theater, which is what I think is really important is to, and I was around a lot of directors, was mostly theater then, but I always did like opera. I got very interested in opera early on. That was kind of through my grandmother who was a pianist. And then on my father's side, the Italians always had, you know, Puccini and Verdi going. And so I think it was just in my blood in some way. And it was interesting in New York at that time, I'm talking in the late 70s, you know, theater was either extremely experimental or very naturalistic. And so I ended up going back to Europe and going to work in opera houses as an intern in Frankfurt, especially. And then, you know, it was sort of one of those things where I knew that I wanted to direct. And so I started getting jobs as an assistant to different people. And that was just invaluable to me. And then, you know, I can keep going. And then it was like, then I got a job finally in my mid-20s working at the San Francisco Opera as what's called a house director or a house assistant, where you work for a lot of people. And of course, being in a major opera house was an incredible eye-opener. And from there, I met a very famous director named Jean-Pierre Pannel, who's French, who brought me to Europe. And I worked for him for a number of years abroad in opera houses, particularly in France and Italy. And then by then, my own career as a director was getting going. I was getting a lot of small jobs. And about that time also, I went to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and started working at a place called The Skylight, which was invaluable for me as a director because I became the artistic director along with Stephen Wadsworth. We were the co-artistic directors, and I was there for 7 years and directed so many shows on a budget of $10,000 and learned so much about directing and making ideas on stage that don't cost anything. And it was kind of a parallel thing. I like did that part of the year, and then part of the year I was working as an assistant for major international directors, particularly Jean-Pierre. And then, you know, then you start to get your jobs if you're lucky. And here we are looking at, I've been doing this more than 40 years.
Yeah, yeah. You have a storied career in this industry. And I think your background in the liberal arts and having that strong philosophy background definitely informs your work, because a lot of it has these deep psychological themes and meaning. Working for all those different directors, you got to see a little flavor of so many different styles that informed your own, surely, as a young artist.
I think I think the best thing when you're starting out or the first 10 years of your career in the theater is really knowing how to watch and learn from other people and interpret it for something that is your own. And also learning how ideas get on stage. You know, that's the thing, is a lot of people have great ideas. They can't make them happen. Yeah. I mean, you know, you, Eric, starting, you know, as a visual artist, in a way, sometimes visually, it's not that it's easier, but you're making something. You know, as a director, it's much more abstract. Mm. You know, the bottom line is you're a storyteller, or at least for me as a director, that's what I think is the bottom line.
Yeah.
And so then you build, you know, all the layers of characters and understanding characters and what makes them tick. But, you know, it's hard to just like say, I'm going to go direct something. Whereas, you know, like you know, you're such a wonderful artist, you know, all the visual things you create, you know, having that fluidity, you know, I envy you. I mean, I know you can sit down and draw something and it comes out looking fantastic in a minute.
It takes two to tango, but I deeply appreciate that. I'm going to isolate that soundbite. I'm going to put it on my phone and play it every now and again. So thank you. But I've always wondered this, and you always talk about the work and you're very, very focused on the work, which is so deeply admirable. But I have to imagine that when you were coming up, it took so much grit and tenacity and straight up stubbornness to make your name as a female artistic director in the time that you were really getting noticed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, like,
how did you deal with it?
I think I was lucky that I had a few mentors who really pushed me and gave me courage of conviction. Mm. There was a lighting designer named Gilbert Helmsley who taught at University of Madison, but he ended up being my roommate, weirdly, in New York City in the early 80s. And he was always just go do it. And he had a big career on Broadway and whatnot by then, but he was important to me, as were a couple of those directors. And yes, of course, listen, you know, believe me, it was not a bed of roses. And, you know, I've told several very famous stories of, you know, when I first started working at the Lyric Opera of Chicago, I was in an office with six men, and there was one toilet in the office, and one of the guys said to me, "Don't expect us to put the seat down for you." He didn't want me there. And you know, there were so many things like that where there's was incredible examples of sexism and discrimination, and from straight men and gay men. I mean, it was two different kinds of power groups when I started. There were a couple of women in power, very few. Elaine Padmore was very important to me. She ran the Wexford Festival, one of the first places I worked in Europe. And then, of course, there were men who supported me and helped me, notable general directors like Ugal in the Paris Opera, and David Gockley at Houston Grand Opera, later San Francisco, and Nick Payne at Covent Garden. But, you know, of course. And I think that's why from an early age, when I got any, as a director, you do have a little power, so to speak. And so I always felt it was important to try to find female collaborators, to cast a Black artist, to, you know, to try and help others who I knew were facing discrimination. And I think some of it, particularly in my late 20s and early 30s, maybe it was more subliminal, but I saw others who weren't in what was, you know, considered the ruling class.
Yeah.
And I think I always had this mentality of how to try and help others on the way up.
And amazing.
By the time I got in my 50s and started, you know, at running the Glimmer Glass Festival and artistic director in Washington, that was just part of my mantra and part of my, you know, to be in a position where you can hire people is truly how you can help affect change. Because hiring and putting people in front of people is what is so important.
It absolutely is. And that's one of the things that I've always loved about working with you, is you have always said that opera is for everyone. The art form should be accessible and it should be understandable. And people who think that their class or their orientation or their race is somehow barring them from entry, that's just a fallacy. And so I've always enjoyed working with you because of that.
I think, you know, what's so funny is that, you know, we, just, you know, we people like you, myself, you know, we have that commitment to opera is for everyone, and meaning inside and out of it. But, you know, when you look at a lot of the historical roots, of course, part of opera came from the court class, but also, you know, I mean, what was the Magic Flute? You know, that was written, Schneider, the producer and writer, you know, and Mozart, they wrote it for the people, you know, mostly, you know, Verdi, when he was writing, you know, for a popular audience. Rossini, they were writing for popular audiences.
Yeah.
So in a way, it's like we were there and then we went away from it, you know?
Yeah.
And that the 20th century made class an issue in classical music. And, you know, that's why I hate classical, because it is about class often.
Yeah.
And, you know, class is obviously connected to all forms of discrimination. And so I think that's just something I've worked for sometimes tirelessly in my career, and sometimes, you know, after fighting my own battles, trying to fight for others. Of course, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Sure. Sure. Absolutely. Well, within class struggles and within racial struggles, there's also gender disparity struggles and orientation struggles. So
right,
you came out in the 80s, and that was like a climate of widespread prejudice from the get-go. Fear was everywhere. AIDS was an enormous threat to everything. And that's a ton of accumulated trauma just from existing in a really bleak time, as an artist or just as a person. And I think a lot of younger people have this idea of the arts as always having been a haven for people of alternative identities. And was that always true? Did you ever feel like you really needed to be careful about sharing yourself at work?
A lot of people who I know in the 80s, like I was always gay. Yes, I was straight. Yes, I had boyfriends, but I think I was always gay. So I never hid it. I don't know if I trumpeted it, but I feel like I went through, you know, the feminist and women's revolution of the 70s.
Yeah.
The 80s being somewhat in the gay revolution, and then, of course, experiencing AIDS. And that's when I was living in San Francisco. So it was full on trauma, and experiencing that and the discrimination and hate against gay people. I think it made me always be like, well, why would I hide this? You know, you want to show that you are just like everyone else. And so I think that the discrimination that I face for being gay, you can't hide it. I mean, even now when I meet people who are gay, I feel like, and they're not out, I feel like, you know, what century are you in?
Right.
And I think that I think that all you do is hurt the society around you if you're not true to yourself. And so I certainly respect many, many trans people who are coming out now more publicly in our field. I think it's kind of the last barrier or frontier in our field. And I think we're trying to figure it out. I'm proud in Washington that, for example, we've started this thing called the True Voice Award, that is for a trans singer. It's a cash prize, and then we include them in activities of our young artist program. I'm certainly proud that I've hired a lot of trans people for jobs.
Yeah,
in various companies, and I think. I mean, it's not as simple as let people be who they are, but it is as simple as that sometimes. You know, the win part of music and theater is merit. And so when people merit it, then we should be making sure that they have the opportunities. Look, we're not at a, you know, Pollyanna world where there's no discrimination. Let's be serious. There's still a ton of discrimination. And a ton of change that has to happen in society on so many levels. But we're in a pretty big revolution right now and have been for 2 years.
Yes. It's enormous in the way that the world has opened up in so many ways. Because when we started working together, I wasn't talking about my transness to anybody I worked with. Because I was...
Right.
I still had that mentality of, well, your career's going to disappear. I mean, these are famous people that you're talking to, you got to keep that stuff buttoned up and just do the work. So,
right. But I mean, I think it's like, I remember when you told me, I was like, oh, okay, fine. I didn't even know. So it was like, okay, next. But I think that, you know, everyone has to make their own decisions like that. And I think I understand your fear and anxiety, and that's why in a funny way, you know, on certain issues like the gay issues, like I find sometimes younger gay people, they don't understand what a lot of us went through for them. They're quite blasé about it. And I'm sure you now have gone through so many things that those who come after you hopefully will be grateful.
I hope it's easier for somebody coming after me.
Right.
Like if I'm old Grandpappy Teague one day telling war stories about having to stand up in a court in my hometown and lobby for a name and a gender marker reassignment, like write an opera about it. That'd be cool. But like, I hope that it's just an easy, commonplace, accepted norm at one point, because it is. It just your reaction to me coming out to you is just the pinnacle of what I wanted. I wanted it to be a non-issue. And so I hope that it's eventually a non-issue. Just like I think in many ways being gay has become a non-issue for most of the civilized world.
Well, the civilized world, yes. I mean, we still have to keep working for so much of the world where there's not there's not gay equality, let alone equality for women. I mean, look at the huge backward steps that we've taken recently in, you know, Afghanistan and places where women can't even, you know, go to school.
Yeah.
So, but I think that all of these things, in a way, make a heightened awareness in the educated world of how they weren't thinking about certain things. Whether it be race, gender, class. I think the most important thing about really this period of change in America has been about awareness. Unfortunately, the result is also about division.
Yeah.
And that we are a more divided culture. The more things have come to the surface, the more divided we have become. And that will be the rift that we'll have to bridge.
Yeah, and it's a constant fight, for sure.
Absolutely.
And I think...
Go ahead. Sorry, no, I was just going to say, but we have a tool in that we are artists. So, like, we have a way to fight these things. You know, we're very lucky about that. That what we do can be... A way to make a bridge, a way to induce conversation, a way to show to people, look, a gay woman did that. Oh, look, a trans person did. Oh, right. Oh, I didn't even know. Oh, okay. I liked it. Okay, fine. You know, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, and then it allows people to discuss. And I think that those are the best things about being in the arts.
Art lets you get outside of yourself enough to be a critical thinker without, yes, you can be moved by the emotions of the stories, but sometimes that removal helps to sort of suss out your own emotions with things. Well, so with so many social issues and you produce lots of work on hot topic items, how do you choose which pieces to support?
Well, of course, you can't do everything. I mean, I think when you do something, you have to commit to it pretty deeply. So I'm very proud about certain projects that I think we have dug deep on. I mean, you've been around Glimmerglass when we've done, you know, strong commitment to, you know, for example, prison reform work at Attica that we've had going for so long, or commitment to youth by creating theater for them, by them, with them. Perhaps more out there, you know, operas we've commissioned like Blue, which now, you know, is being performed everywhere. That's an opera really about police violence against young Black men, but also how does a family heal from that in a community or not heal? And the responses. And that's a piece where it's like, we commissioned it, you stay true to it, you produce it. And now actually in Washington, we've just made a recording, which is being released at the end of this month.
That's awesome.
And a film, an accompanying documentary. So I think it's like I said, this True Voice Award, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think you should dabble. I think you should make a commitment and like follow it through. So we were lucky that, several people came to us with the suggestion of it and that we followed through on it. I think it's like, don't do half-baked projects.
Yeah.
Commit to them and do it all the way. But you can't do everything.
Yes.
You can't be the reformer for everything. All you can do is commit to certain projects. So it's like, I'm thrilled this summer, at Glimmerglass that we're doing an opera called Holy Ground by Damien Geeter and Lila Palmer. And it is really about a woman's right to choose. Mm. Now that's been an issue that's been with us forever. And right now, of course, the Supreme Court is practically about to overturn the women's right to choose.
Yeah.
And so it's a beautiful story about a young woman who is pregnant, whose name is Mary. It's a contemporary story, and it's really about she is deciding whether to have the baby or not. So obviously there's parallels between her and the Virgin Mother, but it's, you know, so that's an issue that I think is very important. It's been important for a long time. And it's like, you know, you want to, you just, again, want to create things where people can think about it and talk about it. And I think, you know, you and I together are working on a wonderful piece this summer called Jungle Book, which is an opera, a youth opera, written by Kamala Zankaram and Kelly Rourke. And, you know, the first questions we asked ourselves, you know, with you, Eric, was like, well, does Mowgli have to be a boy or a girl? Can Mowgli just be gender neutral?
Yeah.
Isn't that better for, you know, for kids? You know, why do we have to make everything so gender specific in theater, particularly that we're putting in front of kids? And it's funny, Jackson, my son, who's 13, I said something recently about somebody and he said, oh, you shouldn't say that. You're supposed to say they're non-binary. And I'm like, okay, Jackson, thank you. You know, and I thought, well, you know, I guess his school is doing a good job in one direction.
Thanks, Jackson.
You know, I mean, he was calling me out on, I can't remember what I said. And I thought, you know, that's the thing where you do see generational shifts. And I think, you know, something like we're doing this summer together with Jungle Book is, again, a way to enforce for kids that all kinds of sexual choices are acceptable, because it's not like there's these sort of strong sexual divisions. I mean, ultimately, it's a piece that's about community and acceptance.
Right.
And accepting, you know, in the original, accepting an outsider into the world there. And I think that's, acceptance is obviously one of the most important things that we can teach kids now.
It's so powerful. Jungle Book is so much about finding your pack and being part of a group. And I think everybody, no matter what their life experience, has that moment of finding your people.
Right.
Because not everybody comes with like a blood family that is connected with your ideas or is into what you want to do. Even my cisgender colleagues who are artists in very non-artistic families, like there's a shared experience of otherness there. And for kids to see something that incorporates a story like that, that turns out well, is so crucial and so important. And I've always liked that you understand engendering a love of the arts comes from day one. Just like you had day one arts exposure, all kids need that.
I think that that's been one of the most gratifying things about a leadership profession, not just a director, but running a company, is you can make a commitment, as we have in Glimmerglass, to youth for most of my tenure to produce works, new works for them with living composers, living librettists, so that they see that opera is not a dead art form.
Yeah.
It's not just something that was written before, but that the creators are alive and well and that they're in contact with all the artists and designers. And actually, usually I direct them because I think it's important that they work with somebody who's like, who's been doing it a while.
Yeah.
So it's funny. I feel like that's one of the main things that we've done at Glimmerglass. Whereas in Washington, I think we've tried with our program called the American Opera Initiative for a decade, we've been doing short new operas that are, you know, that are always about interesting topics of today. And that's been a way to really to speak to themes that maybe don't always get a place. And what's good is they're like 20-minute operas. So they like immediately crack open, you know, a walnut and make you talk about things.
Totally. And they give the young artists in the company a opportunity to really shine in a brand new thing.
Yes.
Yes. Well, okay, when you're, this is a silly question, but when you're not thinking about work, okay, go with me here. What do you like to listen to relax? Like what music?
Oh, that's nice. What do I like to listen to? It's, well, first of all, I love to be in nature. And when I'm in nature, I don't like to listen to anything. I like to listen to nature. That's probably my number one thing, to be truthful. But when I'm doing other things, I love to listen to Baroque music, Handel, all of Baroque music. I love to listen to non-vocal music, often particularly, you know, like piano music, quartets, quintets. I do listen to, you know, a lot of 19th century music. For contemporary music, yeah. I like country western.
Nice.
I listen to that mostly all the time in the car.
Cool.
And around the house when I'm cooking and cleaning, you know, I have it set on country western channels, or I particularly like female vocalists like Brandi Carlile, Iris DeMent, you know, John Prine. I mean, these are the people that I have on my playlists.
Awesome.
Are you surprised by that?
A touch, but I am surprised that Orville Peck wasn't on that list.
Okay.
But that's fantastic. I love, I call it like listening into someone else's headphones, because I feel like you really get a more well-rounded idea of just somebody's casual life versus their work life.
Right.
So that's, thank you for sharing.
I think that's like what's on my, I have on my iPhone here,
perfect.
You know, a couple of playlists that are a lot of those artists. And I have no shame. You know, I'll listen to Dolly Parton.
Oh, I mean, she's a goddess. Why not?
Right. Right.
That's amazing. Well, are there any composers that you return to over and over again as favorites in your career? Or are there any that I've done it once and that's enough?
Oh, living or dead?
It doesn't matter.
Well, I mean, living, I have commissioned Jeanine Tesori
She's
a
great.
Number of times, which has been great, yeah. Wonderful experiences with her. I've worked living with Tobias Picker a number of times and have enjoyed all of that.
He's great.
I think in terms of operatic things, I guess I put Wagner and Verdi as my favorite composers. There's no question. But, you know, it's funny. I don't listen to opera, like sit and listen to opera for fun. I only listen to it really when I'm studying and really focused on it. I know a lot of people like will put it on in the back. I don't like that.
Yeah.
But Wagner and Verdi are my favorite composers to live with and to work on, for sure. And I'm sorry not to have directed all of their works, and hope someday that I might finish the canon and do the ones that I haven't done.
Yeah, you're not done yet.
No.
You got plenty of time left. Well,
you got to make the time count. I will say that's really important in this profession, is that you can't let this profession take over your life. It is part of who you are, but you got to have time for yourself, and you got to have time for the things that you love and the people that you love. That's sort of my most important message that I say to people coming up, is I'm like, give of yourself as an artist, give your soul, but make sure that you also have something to feed your soul.
You can't pour out of an empty cup.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, that's yet another of the things that I have always admired about you. You understand the concept of pencils down time. And that's been a struggle for me to learn. But I've had some good examples. So thank you for that.
Great. Well, I love talking to you, Eric. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me for this chat. And it's been an honor.
Pleasure is mine. And I love working with you. And I'm happy to see your career flourishing.
Thank you so much. So if you, the listener, would like to keep up with Francesca, good luck, I say to you. But her website is a great place to start, francescazambello.com. You can also see pictures from some of our other works together at my website, ericteaguedesign.com, and Opergeist on Etsy and Instagram. A huge thanks goes out to the team at the Atlanta Opera for making this podcast possible. And as always, y'all means all. So come as you are, and your spotlight is waiting. Bye, y'all.